This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're doing Edward Scissorhands. Ooh. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want us to ruin it for you, you might want to pass on this one, and we will see you next time.
Are you ready
for One Dry Kiss?
Woo! Yeah! Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cozy irreverent love letter to rom-coms, where we, in the month of October, are doing... What's the theme?
Supernormal Sweeties, which is inaccurate because it's Supernatural Paranormal Sweeties, if you stick with the elongated version.
Supernatural Paranormal Sweeties.
Did I say supernormal? I said supernormal, didn't I?
Yeah, Supernatural Paranormal Sweeties. We got it. We're on top of our game.
I'm not on top of my game because our neighbor next door is blasting very bad, very like, wah, 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 music, and it's annoying me. And so I'm a little sidetracked, and Corinne's encouraging me to dance along with it, but I will not.
I am. Whenever there's music, I just dance. And today we are doing Edward Scissorhands, and I am here with my co-host, who I think would cut out the dopest paper dolls for me, a la Edward Scissorhands style, Miss Tamara Cosio.
And I am here with the best appliance, no, accessory? No. What do they call kitchen tools?
Appliances. Best. Kitchen appliances.
Okay. No, yeah. But then it sounds like you're a dishwasher. And I want to say you're like the pair of scissors in my life that I need, Corinne Edding.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just want to let you know, Miss Tamara, guess what?
What?
Chicken butt. I'm just kidding. It's my birthday month. It's October.
Oh, yeah. When we release this, it definitely will be in October.
Yes.
Abso-fucking-lutely. Happy early birthday, Corinne. And we are going to be celebrating together in Tejas for Obsessed Fest. We're going to be hitting that up. Going to be passing out some stickers. Going to be promoting ourselves. Going to be real, real fun. Oh, and then there to also meet all of our fucking fabulous podcasts that we listen to. I Think Not.
Yeah.
True Crime Obsessed.
True Crime Obsessed. Let's Go to Court.
And many, 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 many more. And we're super excited to be amongst all the giants and mingling with them. It's going to be so much fun.
Yes. To be clear, we are not on the lineup as we... They would. They would have invited us as part of the lineup, but we are not true crime related.
No.
Although sometimes I do have to say some of these rom-coms that we cover are a crime against rom-coms. But...
Yes.
That is... Beside the point. However, also, because it's my birthday, gentle listeners, we are sharing the birthday love. And if you rate and review us and let us know by sending us one of those sexy DMs, we will send you a limited edition One Dry Kiss sticker. That's right. Ooh, swag. So, for those who want some amazing, designed by Miss Tamara Cosio, One Dry Kiss swag, if you give us that 5-star rating and review and drop DM us, we, for my birthday, for a limited time only in the month of October, we will send you a sticker if you reach out to us.
We're bribing you.
Yes. We're shameless. Also, birthday, gift, celebration. Yay! See?
Oh, yeah.
It's more fun that way. Plus, this would also be like a birthday gift for me, too, so it's reciprocal.
And it's cheap. Like, it's totally, like, free. And you'll even get something. Like, you don't even have to go to the store or go on Amazon. Just leave a 5-star review. It's easy peasy.
And then be like, happy birthday, Cocolicious, because that's what everybody calls me these days. Tamara's giving me the guys.
No, they don't. They don't call you Cocolicious. I hate to tell you. Maybe in your head, they call you Cocolicious, but nobody else, nowhere else.
What?
Yeah.
I feel like you've been holding out on me. Okay, fine.
I know you keep trying to push it, but I'm like, no. You're like, did you mean Cocolicious? No, I meant Corinne. Are you sure you didn't mean Cocolicious? I just went to Starbucks. They wrote it on my cup. Tam, why can't you get on board?
See? And Starbucks is a valid form of ID. Like, if your license is expired and you go to the DMV, they're like, okay, you either need a social security card, your birth certificate, or a Starbucks cup with your name on it. Cocalicious.
But if you're submitting a Starbucks cup, it is your responsibility to make sure that they spelled it correctly. We will not be making modifications. It is exactly as written on the Starbucks cup.
But I didn't want them to write it L-I-S-H-U-S. It's L-I-C-I-O-U-S.
I don't know. I think the shush, like spelled like that, works better for you.
Tamara's struggling today, gentle listeners.
We are recording in the very early hours where we normally record in the very late hours. And I was so excited about it because I'm like, I got my cup of coffee. I'm going to be all energetic. But my apartment sucks in soundproofing. So I hear every little thing. I just moved from the back room to the front room because my neighbor was playing that loud, whatever the fuck music it was. And I thought the living room would be better, but it's not. And now I can hear every car that's going by the very busy street behind me. So apologies. I'm just going to push through though, because I'm not moving again. The pee-pee closet is unavailable. It's full of my stuff now.
Yeah, I'm glad that you are not recording from the pee-pee closet. So yeah.
Yeah. As am I, but right now it would be preferential to all this background noise that I'm hearing that's distracting me. So sorry.
It's so funny because between the two of us, I would think that I would be the one that would be like hella distracted by noises and different things like that.
Yes.
And I'm not. And you are.
No.
And you are totally like twitch, twitch, twitch.
Yeah. I don't know why it is. Like, it's not my personality, but for some reason, when we record, my like senses are heightened. It's like that Spider-Man where you can just like hear everything from miles and miles away.
Ooh. Or like the Bionic Woman.
The Bionic Woman. Because you know, Spider-Man, he could like hear, he could smell, he could sense, he could feel. That's my podcast power. I can hear and I can sense and I can feel and I can smell like everything around me, but not in a good way.
You're like, I'm sorry, gentle listeners. We're not going to be able to record the podcast today. There is an odia. And it is offending my sensibilities.
Not only is that, oh dear, there's a couple five houses down that are having an argument. And I can't have it.
And then in Disneyland, I hear there's one very, very upset child. It's only a few miles away, but I can hear them. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Distract me, Corinne. Distract me.
So, Tamara, do you have a tasty synopsis for us?
I do. A tasty synopsis. By Tamara. T-Synopsis by Tamara. Deep in the heart of Tim Burton land, and hopefully, dear gentle listeners, you will know who Tim Burton is, but if not, he is the man who created such works as Nightmare Before Christmas, Beetlejuice, The Corpse Bride, and more recently, directed the Wednesday series on Netflix, I think
it is. I love that series so much.
So he definitely has a mood, he definitely has a vibe.
Yes.
And inside Tim Burton land, there's a community of little boxes on the hilltop, little boxes full of ticky-tacky little boxes on the hilltop, little boxes that look the same.
And there's big ones and there's small ones and they're all there going ticky-tacky. Yes, they totally, I was thinking the same song. Yes! Thanks, Malvina Reynolds.
I sung it wrong, but you get the idea. AKA a boring subdivision where all the houses, cars, and people look a lot alike.
Yeah.
This place lies in the long shadow of a dark, strange house perched on top of a hill that used to be owned by an eccentric inventor played by Vincent Price. One of the inventor's greatest creations was a man who was as dark and strange as that house. He was named Edward, who is played by Johnny Depp, and has scissors for hands. One day, a determined Avon lady named Peg, played by the wonderful Diane Weist. I want her to be my mom.
Aww!
Who's making a house call brings Edward down into her little ticky-tacky community, where at first, he is welcomed. His first few weeks down there are riddled with events such as getting adopted into a family, falling in love with a girl named Kim, played by Winona Ryder.
In the worst wig ever.
Oh, there was a lot of worst in this movie. The wig just being the beginning of it.
Yeah.
She's wearing a tragic wig that does not go with her face, her body, her life at all.
Her skin coloring. And it's kind of peach colored. It's sort of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He also started a couple of businesses, was sexually harassed did some breaking and entering.
Wow, you're just like going through the entire movie. Okay, we're done.
I was worried about that when I did this outline. I'm like, huh, is that going to do? No, I'll just keep doing it. Okay.
Yeah, keep on going.
Anyways, starting a couple of businesses, being sexually harassed, breaking and entering, getting into an ill-advised fistfight, and ultimately being ostracized from the community that previously embraced him. What the heck transpired to make poor Edward fall from a hero to a zero? And more importantly, does he get the girl? Does he get justice for that harassment? Does he finally find his place in the ticky-tacky community? Find out with us as we cut into the fantastical tale that is Edward Scissorhands.
Yay!
Corinne's going to jump right in, but she completely cut the very first section of the movie that I really want to talk about, Corinne, even though we don't have to like outline it specifically.
Yeah, because... let's just address it. I just did not want to script it out because it is a nothing burger. It is at the beginning and the very end of this movie, and it's like, why? Why did you think, you know what? It's going to be a great idea. Let's put Winona Ryder in a bunch of old lady makeup. Let's start with that. Why?
Mm-hmm. Bad old lady makeup. And very she does bad. Not pass as an old lady. I'm an old lady now. And I'm like, no, Winona Ryder, we all see how beautiful you are under all that. Stop it. But the old lady is telling the story of how Snow came to their ticky-tacky community. So it's more like a fairy tale. So she's sitting her little granddaughter down.
And it's not like her voice, her old lady voice comes throughout the entire movie. It's just at the very beginning and the very end.
Yes. Yeah. Just wanted to address it, though, because I wanted to talk about how we see you, Winona. You do not pass as an old lady. Okay, continue with the actual beginning, Corinne.
It's also disappointing in that the room is oddly proportioned that she's in, like the scale of the bed and the it was a strange tacked on beginning and end. But yes, we will move on. Two. Who is that shadowy man?
He's Edward Scissorhands.
Who is that shadowy man?
He's Edward Scissorhands.
He lurks in the dark.
Edward Scissorhands.
His hands are very sharp.
Edward Scissorhands. Well, there's no theme song in this movie, but we just made one up. Shit.
Yes. Thank goodness. Woo. It needed a little theme action.
Let's go back to the top and do it again then. Are you ready for One Dry Kiss?
Peg, an entrepreneurial Avon lady living in pastel-colored house suburbia, as Tamara said, and I had been thinking about doing, little houses on the hillside, little houses going ticky-tacky. When I saw this, immediately thought of that, so I'm glad that we're on the same wavelength. Peg is in her lavender Chanel-style suit with matching pillbox hat and a 90s bob with bangs sculpted halfway into a cresting ocean wave. Very much the style of the times. The other part hairsprayed to perfection, creating a beautiful line directly under the bottom of her eyebrows. She's going from house to house with her turquoise Avon bag full of makeup. But as happens with all MLMs, the market is saturated and no one wants in. Peg decides that it's time for her to find new territory. That's when her eyes catch on the mansion on the hill. It looks over the suburban valley that she lives in and definitely isn't a house that she's tried before.
I wonder if anybody... I used to have an older lady that sold Avon at when I bowled in a kind of senior-esque bowling league.
Uh-huh.
And she was the... I hate to say it. I'm not going to say her name. But she was very hard to know, a.k.a. annoying. But she would just, like, go around and she would, like, pass out the Avon bowling books while you were throwing your ball. And then when you sat down, she'd be like, "And Tamara, I left you a booklet." And I'm like, I don't care. I don't want your booklets. If you tried to hand it to me, I would refuse it. But then she always like probably figured that out and just like left it somewhere obvious and then was like, "Oh, I left you that and I'm going to run away so you can't give it back to me."
You're like looking over your shoulder. You turn around and there's like an Avon booklet in your cleavage. You're like, "Wait a minute. How did this get here?"
Read, read, read.
Oh.
Yeah, she was the ninja Avon lady. It was very interesting. And I bought, like, I think not from her, but in the past 6 or 7 years, I think I might have bought a few things from Avon during, like, the holidays or whatever. And they were so cheaply made. It was such, it was like Wish in a catalog. Yeah, it looked pretty, and then you got it, and you're like, what the fuck?
The only MLM I've bought from has been, I think it was like Bare Essentials or something like that. I can't remember. I went to some makeup party, and I got myself like a little thing, and yeah, it was fine.
I do like a good Pampered Chef party, though. Those...
I think Pampered Chef is the only kind of MLM where people have like a somewhat reasonable-ish kind of incentive program.
But their products are like really, they're almost like, it dices, it slices. It's like an infomercial, but with like kitchen stuff at the same time. So sometimes they just have like good quality things. Like my sister still has 3 things that she bought from Pampered Chef from like 17 years ago. And then sometimes they just have some really outrageous, crazy, like, oh my God, I never knew I needed that in my life. I bought this salad bowl that was like a salad holder on the bottom, like a big bowl. And then it had a top portion, like a bento box that covered it. So you can put like all your little salad accessories on top. And then there was even like a colander that sat inside the bowl so you could rinse everything off and then potentially get a knife and cut through the... It was insane. I did not use any of it, but... theory, it looked really good.
Well, yeah, and then your salad doesn't get soggy. It's perfect.
Yeah. I used the bowl still and the lid, and that's about it. All the other stuff that came with it that I thought was so jazzy and neat, I pretty much threw it away. I'm not going to use this ever. Wonderful in theory, not great in execution. But still, you don't know until you buy it.
Yeah, but my mom, she's bought from MLM. She never sold for them. She bought from MLM. So she's like had, we've had different Tupperware stuff in our household, as well as she bought a lot of Mary Kay cosmetics.
Ah, yes. The height of sophistication.
I know. Mary Kay. And you know you've made it big when you're driving around in a pink Cadillac, Mary Kay style.
Your mom never had a pink... Oh, wait, she didn't sell for...
No, she did not sell for Mary Kay. Are you kidding me? She never would have done that. But she would help a friend out and get some makeup in the process. Mm. Sure. Pig hops into her custard yellow 1974 Plymouth Duster. Thank you, Internet. And heads up to the mansion. The security gate has fallen down, so Peg drives right on over it and parks outside the garden gates. She walks through the old gate. Did I mention that there are gates here?
I did see that a time or two, yes.
Yeah. Okay, just in case you were wondering.
But was there a gate?
Well, perhaps, because there were other gates as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes. So gates that were fallen, gates that were still up, gates to go through.
Keep reading.
And gates to close.
She keeps going. Go again. Keep reading.
All right. So she walks through the old gate, past a waterfall of ivy. And once she's on the garden path inside the gates, she sees a topiary wonderland. Shrubs topiaried into the Loch Ness Monster, petrodactyls, a bounding dog, a giant hand. I'm guessing that half of this movie's budget was spent on fancy topiary bushes. Peg looks around in wonder and makes her way beyond the gates to the giant wooden door. She knocks, but no one answers. So she just pushes the heavy door open, calling out, "Hello, hello, Avon calling." No one answers, and she wanders around the grand entrance, completely ignoring the ghoulish statue at the foot of the stairs. That thing was fucking creepy as hell. I was like, what is that, the Slender Man?
The whole thing was creepy. I would not walk in there. I'd be like, not worth it. I'm not putting up with this shit for a pink Cadillac. Like, I'm sorry, I'm out.
Well, you know, you're not going to get to the top of the pyramid with that kind of attitude, Tamara.
I don't think I'd get to the top of the pyramid with any attitude, Corinne. That's the whole point.
Oh, Pig sees a shadow move and hears the sound of scissors slicing. through the air. And as only a woman with the protection of white privilege can, she hoofs it up the stairs towards the noise, saying, "My name is Peg. I'm from Avon. Hello." As she continues up the stairs, she explains, "I'm sorry to barge in like this, but you don't have any reason to be afraid. Just, wow, this is such a big house. Thank goodness for those aerobics." She trails off as she enters a room on the upper floor. The roof has a giant hole in it, and there seems to be some kind of shrine against the side of the wall. Her eyes catch some movement in the corner. "Oh, you don't have to hide from me. My name is Peg Boggs, and I'm your local Avon representative. I'm as harmless as cherry pie." She trails off once again as a silhouette with stabby-looking fingers approaches her. Fortunately for her, it's not Freddy Krueger, who has knife blades at the end of his fingers, but a much more harmless and very awkward goth-looking young man with scissors for hands. He's wearing an entirely black leather outfit, and his hair is tangled and dark black. His face is pale with light scars all over it as a result from accidental nicks and cuts from his scissor hands.
And mind you, gentle listeners, this man is a young, very hot Johnny Depp, so
yes.
He makes the crazy black hair and the bondage gear work in a way that is unexpected and surprising.
I know. He gives off this sensitive vibe that you wouldn't think would be possible in an outfit and when with hair like that.
He's the sensitive S&M man. "I want to control you with love and kisses."
"Here, let me cut you some little paper doll deer." Ring.
Peg sees him, pauses a beat, and says, "Well, I gotta go," and starts beating a hasty retreat out of the room, but stops when the young man softly says, "Please don't leave." And Peg, after selling Avon for years and years, has really gotten a good read on people and their energy, and she could see pretty immediately that this young man is lonely and needs some love, and she's the one to give it to him because she's just so motherly and maternal, and I love her and everything she does, and says, "You know what? I'm taking you home with me." And the young man obligingly gets into her car with her. As they drive, Edward marvels at very mediocre things. He sees a lawnmower and tries to point it out to Peg, almost taking off her nose. She's startled, and he realizes his mistake and puts his scissor hands between his legs. Next, he sees an exciting hedge and bonks his head on the doorframe, trying to get a better look, making it more and more obvious that he doesn't get out much. As they drive through the neighborhood, various neighbors, a.k.a. bored housewives of ticky-tacky community, see Peg with her mysterious passenger, and they casually, not casually, make their ways inside so they can telephone each other and gossip about her strange visitor. When Peg comes up to her house and ushers Edward inside, the neighbors all conspire to meet on the corner where Peg's house is so they can work out what is happening, because it's totally their business and they need to be informed. Correct?
Totally. Also, okay, I have a strange beef to pick with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So they live in this community where everybody, like, drives a fucking car. Everybody has a garage. Like, nobody parks on the street. The garage is attached to the house. There's like a full-on driveway, everything like that. So Peg's house is on the corner. Where does she park her car? On the side corner, not on the driveway. She walks like just like randomly across the lawn with Edward into the house. And I'm like, why wouldn't you just park your fucking car in the driveway and walk up the tiny little path that's closer to the door? And they do this like a second time later in this movie where it makes even less sense. And I'm like, you've got a driveway. Why aren't you using your fucking driveway? Question mark, question mark.
All of the issues with this movie. And that's the hill you're going to die on, Corinne. I have one issue, one bearing, glaring issue.
Okay, I have a confession to make, Tam.
Mm-hmm.
When I chose this movie, I had very soft feels in my heart for it. I thought, oh, quirky, you know, kind of alternative love movie, supernatural love movie. And I saw it when it first came out in the movie theaters. I saw it in the theater.
Right.
I'm very confused about how I feel about this movie. I don't know. I just don't know. There's things where I'm like, have you directed a movie before, Tim Burton? I'm very confused by this moment, etc.
Do you know how driveways work, Tim Burton?
Yeah. No. For the record, Tim Burton does not know how driveways work.
Apparently not. Good thing he knows how gates work.
Yeah. Lots of gates. But they do get inside the house, regardless of the strange parking job, regardless of the fact that we never see a car parked in front of their house after the moment that she parks the car there. It magically disappears into, I'm guessing, the garage. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Inside the house, Peg shows her guest around, and he stops in front of several framed photos. She points out her husband, her son Kevin, and her daughter Kim. He looks softly at Kim's photo, and it's pretty clear that it's love at first sight for him. Peg takes him to Kim's room and hands him some clothes so that he can change into something a little more mainstream than the black leather bondage gear he's currently wearing. Once he's left alone, his eyes catch a figure across the room from him. He walks up to the confusing-looking person and reaches his scissor hands towards him, ultimately tapping on the glass and discovering that the person he sees is himself. He's taking a look at the man in the mirror. Mm-hmm. Except he's not doing it in a self-reflective way. He's doing it in a, oh, this is my reflection way. He works on changing into the pants and white collared shirt, but not before poking a hole in Kim's waterbed. And now we all know, since we've moved past the 90s, that waterbeds are just not a way to go. No. Edward hastily covers the hole with a stuffed animal. Peg, in the other room, makes a quick call to her husband, informing him of what's going on. And as soon as she hangs up the phone, she flips on the answering machine. And when she checks on her guest, she walks in on him, completely tangled in the white button-down shirt. She gently asks him if she can help, and her voice is like a warm hug. She should be a hostage negotiator. Like, she should be the person who talks anyone off the ledge, because she could do it.
Yeah.
She's got sweet, soft, big mama energy in, like, the most lovable way, and yeah. That's the only way he would have gotten into the car with her. You know, he wouldn't have gotten in the car with just about anyone.
I might get in the car with her. You're not supposed to ride with strangers. But if she approached me, I'd be like, okay.
I just see her pulling up. She's got her little pillbox hat on. She's like, oh, hi. Would you like to go for a ride with me? I have these Avon catalogs here.
Not supposed to ride with strangers. I have candy, too. Okay.
And a really great eyeliner. Oh, well, in that case. Edward acquiesces and lets Peg help. She quickly sorts out the shirt, and he looks a little less like he's going to the power exchange in San Francisco and a bit more like he's going to a Cure concert, dressed as a lookalike of their lead singer, Robert Smith, during his big hair and white button-down shirt days.
For sure.
Peg lets him know that she has a doctor friend who may be able to help him, and his eyes light up with hope. And can we talk... Can we talk about this for a moment? You know how many times people say throughout this fucking movie, I have a doctor friend who may be able to help you.
Do we see
a doctor?
No, because at first, like, Edward realizes too. Peg says, and he's like, oh, somebody could help. And then somebody else, the barbecue later on, says, and he's like, oh, somebody else can help. And I've heard third or fourth time that somebody says it to him, he's like, yeah, I've heard this before. Whatever. I see no doctor. We're fucking big thanks, but no thanks.
Uh-huh.
Because there's no follow through in this ticky-tacky community.
No. You know, he could have regular hands, and then he could fucking use scissors to do his scissory thing. Like, come on.
I really think that's a bad decision for prosthetics, that maybe he should just get one of those little clampy hook things that aren't going to be weapons of mass destruction if he's enraged. I'm just putting it out there.
Okay, fine. You know, you do you with your non-creative ways of handling things, but...
I'm just a regular person that way. I'm so sorry.
I mean, he's dressed like he's going to the power exchange. Why wouldn't he, like, have hands like he's going to the power exchange? Hey.
Okay.
While all this is going on inside the house, the lady neighbors gather round Peg's house on the sidewalk, trying to see what's going on inside. From a modest distance on the sidewalk, but no dice. As the sun goes down and the streetlights pop on, suddenly a stream of cars drive back into the neighborhood, and the women quickly scurry back to their respective houses to be home for their husbands. Aw, how very Stepford Wives of them.
Yeah. Over dinner, we find out that their guest's name is Edward. Edward sits around the table with Peg's husband, Bill, who insists on calling him Ed, and Peg's son, Kevin, who is fascinated by Edward and wants to take him to show and tell at school. Peg shuts that shit down with a swiftness, telling her husband that Edward prefers to be called Edward and for her son to slow his roll, but in her beautiful, warm, buttery, sweet voice. Edward's not going to school with him. He doesn't meet Kim, though, as she's on a camping trip with her boyfriend and friends. While the conversation buzzes around Edward, he awkwardly struggles to find out how to eat with his scissor hands. He tries balancing a few peas between his quote-unquote fingers before accidentally launching them across the room. He's very adept at cutting a pat of butter that Peg offers for his bread, and finally he resorts to shish kebabbing his food onto his scissor fingers and eating them that way. The next day, Peg tries using her advanced Avon makeup skills on Edward, who placidly sits there as she paints him lavender and then tries putting his face to obscure his scars. But nothing works, or at least nothing that Avon possesses works. And she obviously needs to get herself a drag queen friend stat, because the queen would know how to completely transform Edward's face. But Edward, he doesn't really need makeup other than being very pale. His face has a sweet vulnerability that works for him. And maybe Peg should rethink her career as an Avon lady. As said before, he's got that sweet, vulnerable S&M vibe going on that just totally works for him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I gotta say, Peg is not so good with the makeup.
Well, I mean, have you ever tried shellacking a face? I'm imagining it's pretty complicated.
Yeah, I would think that we would want to warm up his color a little bit with not lavender. And
yeah, the lavender was an interesting step. I'm like, you want to contrast the paleness, not add to it. Let's make him more sallow and and like more corpse. That's what I'm going for.
Over the weekend, while Kevin and his friends hang out in the backyard treehouse listening to the baseball game on the radio, and Bill, played by Ed Asner, thanks Ed, yells at his son to turn up the radio so he can hear it as he clips the hedge half-heartedly. Edward sees from Bill that, yes, it's okay to clip these hedges, so away he goes with his scissor hands, creating a fantastic T-Rex topiary out of one of the family hedges. Once Bill sees the amazing hedge, he is happy to be relieved of bush trimming duty and leaves the rest of the bushes to Edward, while Bill grabs a lawn chair and beer, enjoying the day, while he watches the game on a TV that he carted out into the yard. Peg, who is inside the house, listens to the messages on her answering machine, remarking, "It's completely full," as she hears neighbor after neighbor asking for all the deets about the mystery guest. Edward creates a topiary family out of four of the bushes Bill had previously been reluctantly clipping away at, and all seems well until their creepy neighbor, Esmeralda, who lives across the street and seems very religious, comes through their back gate exclaiming, "He!" She points accusingly at Edward. "He has risen straight from the hellfire into our community. You have brought Satan into our community. Can you feel it? Or have you poor sheep strayed so far from the path that you can't see it?"
Just because he looks weird, lady, really check yourself. There's nothing in the Bible that says you can't have leather bondage gear and crazy hair and a pale complexion. What does it say that? Exodus 3:75. "Thou shalt not have spiky black hair, a pale complexion, and S&M leather gear."
Oh, I didn't know about that verse of the Bible. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well known.
I'm surprised it's not on a t-shirt that televangelists all over the world wear.
Well, it's not one of those thoroughly followed one, which is why she probably saw fit to come over and like share it with them.
You are chock full of the more obscure Bible knowledge, and I appreciate that about you, Tamara.
Sure am.
Edward, who can't read the room, approaches the neighbor, saying softly, "We're not sheep." The neighbor quickly backs away. "Don't come near me," and runs off. Bill yells half-heartedly after her, "That's right, run." And Peg, who has just come out and had been previously admiring the topiary that Edward made of their family, tells Edward, "Now don't you pay her no mind." Bill seconds this. "She's just a loony. Ignore her."
Loony, loony, loony.
Peg hears the doorbell and runs back into the house to answer it. When she opens it, she's greeted by a chorus of "Hi!" from a cluster of six women, with all with their own unique hairstyles and one singular mission: find out who the fuck is at Peg's house. Peg isn't eager to give them details, but Joyce, who is very lonely, very bored, and a force to be reckoned with, asks without provocation, "What time's the barbecue?" Peg tries to politely say, "Now's not a good time because things are hectic," but Joyce pushes on as if she doesn't hear her protests and proposes, "How about 5? I'll bring my ambrosia salad." Then adds for good measure, "You wouldn't want to be rude and not introduce your guests to all your friends in the neighborhood, right? Right?" As the gaggle leaves to get ready for the impromptu barbecue, Esmeralda again appears in the front yard and announces cryptically from the corner of the lawn, "He's been sent from hell to tempt you, but it's not too late. Cast him out! Trample down the perversion of nature!" Joyce chuckles and turns back to Peg. "Well, did you hear that? He's a perversion of nature. Isn't that exciting?" And with that, the gaggle of busybodies scurry off, and Peg ducks into the house to get ready for the barbecue. Fortunately, she has the help of Edward, who slices and dices a head of lettuce in 5 seconds flat, and accidentally cuts his face in the process, as he does from time to time, given his sharp, long, multi-scissored hands. Peg quickly scoops the lettuce away from him before he turns it into a puree and dabs at his fresh nick, assuring him, "Esmeralda won't be there, and you just need to be yourself, and you'll be fine." She goes over to the electric can opener and starts opening a can, which causes Edward to have a flashback. We see Edward's dad, a.k.a. the inventor who lived on the hill. He has a whole robot assembly line making cookies. Little robots with cookie cutters for feet stamp out different shapes into the dough, while a robot on another assembly line is chop, chop, chopping celery with his knife hands. The inventor grabs a freshly baked heart cookie and holds it up to the chopping robot's chest. And he is inspired. What's he going to do with that cookie? Is he going to eat your heart out? We'll find out later.
And the inventor is played by Vincent Price, who does such a sweet job playing him.
I love Vincent Price's voice. Remember all the stuff he did back in like the 80s and 90s, just because he had that like just prolific voice that you could recognize anywhere.
Where I grew up with him, he did the intro and outro for Mystery on PBS. Mm-hmm. And so he would introduce and close out the show. And then there'd be like the British mystery program in the middle. And, Vincent Price, he's like Peg and Vincent Price, they come from the same family, even though like he in some ways is like a king of horror, because he was also in like all these like old horror movies and stuff like that. But yeah,
mm-hmm.
Anyways. Back in the present, the barbecue is in full swing, and the music, "Is it hot in here, or is it just me?"
No, we're not bringing that track back. Gentle listeners, that was a very bad jam that was in Mystic Pizza a couple of episodes again, and Corinne saw fit to look it up online to see if she could track down who sang that song or who created it, and she could not, because it was so bad. There is no track record of who or what did that ditty.
I'm sure it's in the credits for Mystic Pizza, but I was trying to find the lyrics just to get the full picture of what the song was saying about. Is it hot in here? Is it just me? Instead, I got a bunch of Nelly being like, "It's so hot in here. Let's take off all our clothes. I am feeling so hot. I want to take my clothes off." As the answer. So Google failed me. Thank you, Google.
Bummer.
Yeah.
So crazy and surprising that it found that Hot in Here song over the 80s obscure rendition that was playing in the background of a bar of Mystic Pizza from 88. Don't know why they just didn't pinpoint that and extract it right out of that search engine that you were looking for.
I think it was part of the, you know, hot summer songs of 88. What are you talking about?
along with that saxophone solo that was in a couple of scenes later. Ooh. Oh, the Mystic Pizza soundtrack, the songs that we keep talking about episodes later. Yep.
So the men of this neighborhood are full of dad jokes and not listening to music from Mystic Pizza or other things.
Or Nelly.
Yeah, or Nelly. And they say things to Edward to make him feel bad. And then they essentially finger gun him and saying, "Just kidding. It's a joke. Can't you take a joke?" Ah, love those. Love those moments. The women, on the other hand, are ready for a slice of Edward. They swarm him, enthralled by how different he is, and competitively spoon their different jello salads into his mouth, hoping for him to say something like, "Wow, Joyce, this is the best ambrosia salad I've ever tasted in my life. Thank you for changing me with this mouthful of jello and Cool Whip." Instead, he just stands stunned in front of a small grill with vegetables skewered onto his scissors, barbecuing them and trying to swallow mouthful after mouthful of strange concoction that's spooned into his mouth. Bill sees what's going on and yells, "Soup's on!" indicating that the food was ready and getting the ladies to scatter. Edward says, with a mouthful of jello concoction number 3,
"I thought we were having shish kebabs."
Bill says, "Huh?" He says more clearly,
I thought we were having shish kebabs."
Bill shakes his head. "We are. It's a figure of speech. No need to be so literal." But Johnny Depp, he jumped the shark with the Pirates of the Caribbean and his performances after that. And I see this performance, though, and I really want to sit down with him and have like a serious interview and say, "Do you remember having your mouth shoved full of Cool Whip Jello Delights? How was that? You look kind of grossed out."
I don't think I have enough ambrosia in my life, actually.
You need more ambrosia salad?
I do.
Do we need to invite Joyce over?
No. I'm sure there's other people in the world that can make ambrosia salad besides Joyce, but I just don't think I have enough of it in my life. And when I saw that little ticky-tacky neighborhood scene, I'm like, why doesn't anybody in my family make ambrosia salad?
You're not in the Midwest, that's why. Yes.
Ah, gotcha.
You culturally grew up in the wrong place.
And by the way, what time frame is this supposed to be taking place in? Is it like the 60s? The 70s?
No. It's a nebulous time frame because it has like that very stylistic, you know, kind of 50s, 60s look to it. But then it's got the van, which is not from either of those eras. That van is 80s all the way, you know, and some of those hairstyles are much more 90s kind of hairstyles. So, yeah, it's of every time. It's timeless, Tamara. It's timeless.
Gotcha.
Tamara's raised her eyebrows in my comment in regards to it being timeless.
Oh, you couldn't see that on the podcast? Oh,
I think that she may have a little beef to pick with that statement. Mm. But that evening, while Edward is trying to sleep in Kim's room, he flashes back to his life in the house on the hill. His inventor dad has transformed him from a little metal chopping robot dude to the Edward we see today. Well, mostly. He appears to be a torso propped on a table with arms, scissor hands, and his head, but his legs are piled on the table next to him, having yet to be installed. Inventor dad is reading him etiquette from Emily Post's book on manners, and then moves on to reading him a limerick from a book of poetry. "There was an old man from the Cape who made himself garments of crepe. When asked, 'Will they tear?' he replied, 'Here and there, but they keep such a beautiful shape.'" Edward's mouth twitches upon hearing the limerick, and inventor dad encourages him. "Go ahead, smile. It's okay. It's funny. You should smile." Cue Edward smiling very creepily for the first time.
Also, late that evening, Kim is arriving home a day early from her camping trip. She gets dropped off in a big van with big flames painted on the side that Corinne just mentioned before, and cans tumble out of it when the slide door is opened. She grabs her stuff, says goodbye to her jock boyfriend and the gaggle of friends that were with her, and heads into the house. Oh, so grateful to be done with her camping adventure and looking forward to taking a shower and crawling into bed. She gets into her room, takes off her socks and shoes, and the whole while, Edward, who's been staying in her room while she was away, because when I read the next line, I'm like, it sounds like he was skulking in a corner. But Corinne's original writing, because I was like, let me clarify, is silently watching her from the bed, unsure of what to do. She takes off her sweater and fortunately has an emotional support cami underneath that. Fortunately squared, she stops stripping off her clothes and stops in front of the mirror to try to pop an invisible zit. However, something catches her eye and she glances towards her bed only to see a terrifying, very pale man with multiple hatchets lying in wait for her. She screams. He screams. They scream. Kim runs screaming to her parents' room while Edward springs up from the waterbed, stabbing it multiple times in panic and creating a momentary gushing sprinkler effect. Kim's parents quickly separate the hysterical Kim and the very confused Edward while Peg calms her daughter. Bill brings Edward down to the basement so they can have a man-to-man talk. Bill sits him down and pours him a couple of fingers of scotch into a tumbler and calls it lemonade. Edward looks it up. Edward looks it up and down and says, "Great, I love Beyonce."
Nice one.
Just kidding. Beyonce didn't leave in this ambiguous time period yet.
Destiny's Child was yet a twinkle in the eye.
Yes. Bill throws his tumbler of scotch back and talks vaguely about how he suspects that Edward has a thing for Kim and how at some age suddenly girls just swell up and get real mysterious. The whole time Bill's mumbling women theories, Edward has been chasing the glass around with his scissors, not being able to pick it up, until finally Bill plops a straw into lemonade. Winky winky. Ooh. I don't think you're ready for this jelly. I don't think you're ready. I'm sorry, that's not on the Lemonade album.
No, it's not.
And Edward innocently sucks it all down. But it's not what he was expecting. He slowly straightens up, his eyes watering and wheezing emitting from the back of his throat. Upstairs, Peg is talking to her daughter, who's not at all happy about the surprise visitor. Peg gently explains the situation to Kim, but Kim cannot understand why they have to be his foster family. Her mom pulls out the spare bed in Kevin's room and says, "Now, Kim, just for tonight, we'll have you sleep in Kevin's room, and then tomorrow we'll fix up your bed. Now, you scared Edward pretty badly, so let's go downstairs and we could properly introduce you two and smooth things over." Kim's miffed. "I scared him? He scared me!" But Peg insists. They go down to the basement. Peg softly introduces Edward, whose head is down on the bar. "Edward, this is Kim." Edward moves his head up, eyes wide, looks at both of them, and then immediately falls like a plank of wood, stiff and straight onto the floor, and I'm sure this doesn't help Kim's impression of him.
No. And while Edward may be winning over the ladies in the neighborhood by creating unique topiary creations for them, although Joyce wasn't thrilled when she offered him lemonade and he looked at her with horror and then barfed on her shoes, and I say, she, Miss Sexual Harasser, gets all the barf on her shoes. Thank you very much. He is winning over elementary school students when Kevin is finally allowed to take him to show and tell. He's not winning over Kim, who finds him to be, ew, gross. She's a cheerleader, has a hot jock boyfriend, and doesn't want the embarrassing Edward anywhere near her. However, she has little choice in the matter. While she sits at the dinner table, flanked by her bestie on one side and her boyfriend on the other, directly across from her, Edward is sawing away at a roast with his scissor hands, handing out slices of freshly cut meat. Ugh. How embarrassing. Am I right?
No. You'd be like, cool. That's awesome.
I know, right?
I'm not going to have to wash those later, right?
Edward offers her friend a slice of meat. I spelled it M-E-E-T. Great. But she looks at him with disdain. Ew, no, you've touched it with your hands. That's not sanitary. He then offers it to Kim, who knows she can't get away with saying that. So she just looks at him and the meat until he accidentally drops it onto her lap instead of on the plate. Oh, cruel world, why do you hate me?
Can we just discuss also how this, I think this might have been the first movie that Anthony Michael Hall actually does not look like a frail kind of He was always kind of portrayed as the geeky boy, for lack of better words, but he was in such 80s hits as like Weird Science and The Breakfast Club, and he was always like the nerdy guy in the back, yeah, the small frail, like, hey, I'm just trying to be your friend, I love science. And in this one, he is the quintessential good-looking jock boyfriend, which was such a stretch. And I was just like, is that Anthony Michael Hall? What the fuck happened to him?
Well, and were you the one that told me that he turned down the role of Ducky in Pretty in Pink because he didn't want to be typecast?
I don't think so.
Well, I know this piece of information. And he did not want to be the geek. And so he worked hard on it. And he was not the geek in Johnny B. Goode that was in 1988 before Edward Scissorhands.
Ah, so that was like his transition.
Yeah.
So gentle listeners, do yourself a favor. Look at Anthony Michael Hall in 16 Candles
and Weird Science. Yeah.
And then look at him in Edward Scissorhands. And it's like night and day. It's so crazy.
Oh, yeah. He goes from being an adorable geek. And apparently this movie called Out of Bounds, but never seen that.
I don't think anybody has.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. Johnny B. Goode, I remember seeing in the video stores. This, have not seen. But he goes from playing like this, like really sweet, kind of stammery, like little guys to a giant asshole who obviously he did like some steroids or something to get his muscles on or something like that. I don't know. It was just.
Or he just had a growth spurt. Maybe it was just one of those late life growth spurts.
Could have been.
Focus, Corinne. We're recording a podcast.
I know. You got me going down a time. It's all your fault. You've distracted
me. No rabbit holes right now.
Yeah, because Weird Science, I mean, Pretty in Pink was in 1986. And Weird Science, The Breakfast Club, and 16 Candles were like 1985, 1984. Okay, I'm back in. I'm in. I'm focused. Ready to go. No rabbit hole. No more rabbit holes.
The next day, as Edward is finishing a topiary of a girl twirling in a skirt, he spies a shaggy dog lying down in the shade of the shrub, and he gets an idea. Maybe this shaggy doggy could use a little trimmeroo, am I right? Just like these bushes. So he goes snippety snip snip, and fur flies everywhere. And when he's done, much to the surprise of the woman who owns Alexis the shaggy dog, Alexis rounds the corner to her person looking like a beautiful pom-pommed standard poodle. Alexis's person is thrilled.
Oh my God. Sure wish Edward was next door neighbor right now. Melody needs a trim. Before Edward knows it, he's doing dog grooming. Peg is managing it, and hopefully he's getting paid. And all the neighbors are lined up to get their dogs in Edward original do. Joyce has Edward cut her small yappy dog named Kisses hair. And she's so inspired, she grabs the lawn chair and tells him, do me, do me. And by do, she means cut her hair. And much like the pottery scene in Ghost, he makes love to her with those scissors and hair flies everywhere. And as Joyce sighs orgasmically until she ends up with a very stylish asymmetrical bob. He then ends up giving the women of the neighborhood various and unique punk rock hairstyles, and he even does Peg's hair, but when Kim comes home, she does not approve of it. Later, neighbor Helen takes Edward into town to get his scissors sharpened. Say that five times fast. To get his scissors sharpened. And when he sees Kim in the distance with her boyfriend, it's obvious that he wants some of that. He sadly watches them as they hug and then run carefree into the big van with big flames painted on the outside. Later, he gets back home to find Kim and jock boyfriend Jim waiting outside. Kim can't find her key and no one's home, so she's locked out. Edward handily uses his scissors to unlock the door, and Jim observes, wow, you just took care of that without a mark. And we can see his brain hamster churning away on that wheel for potential ways to exploit Edward. And we don't like it. Not one bit.
No.
You know, I always, when this part came on and after watching the Barbie movie recently, I'm like, what does Edward have going on downstairs?
Oh, for 100%. I was like, it's just stuffing down there. Like, yeah.
Stuffing. Thank God it's not a pair of scissors down there.
Oh!
Edward Scissor Penis. I mean, it seemed that inventor kind of put stuff that weren't necessarily you know, matching in place of appendages and limbs until he could get to them. So maybe it's a whisk.
I was thinking that, okay, a funnel.
A funnel. Okay. Yeah. A funnel. Edward funnel penis. Edward.
That's like the penis. That's the porn version of Edward Scissorhands. It's Edward funnel penis.
Edward rolling pin penis. That's interesting.
Edward wine bottle. Edward magnum of champagne penis. Are you happy to see me, or is that just a magnum of champagne in your pants? That just rolls off the tongue, you know?
Oh, so easy, yeah. Yeah. Surprised I didn't accidentally blurt that out myself.
Later, neighbor Helen takes Edward into... Oh, wait, no. No, you said that. I'm reading your lines. What am I talking about? Also, neighbor Helen, though, is played by Leona from Mystic Pizza.
Oh, yeah, she is. Leona.
That's not her actual name. That's the...
No.
But that's the name of the role that she played in Mystic Pizza. Later, Edward and Peg are on a local talk show. And I said, Edward and Peg are on a talk show with one of the hosts of That's Incredible!
Oh, wow.
So they're on the talk show and Edward is answering questions. And That's Incredible is a show from the early 80s, I think, where they would have different people on it who had talents of various sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this person who can juggle chainsaws, or watch this person ride a bicycle across on a tightrope, that kind of a thing.
That's incredible.
Exactly. You know what's incredible? Edward Scissorhands.
That's why he's on the show. Makes sense.
Edward is answering questions from the audience. One person shares that she may have a doctor who can help him with his hands.
Sure, Jan, sure.
Big nothing burger there. Edward responds, I'd like that. But someone else is appalled. Your hands are what make you special. If you got rid of them, you wouldn't be special anymore. Peg responds, Edward will always be special, no matter what. Then a young woman in the audience asks, do you have a girlfriend? The audience woos. And back at home, Kim, Jim, the boyfriend, and Kevin, the brother, are watching the screen intently. Jim and Kevin tease Kim about being Edward's girlfriend, and Kim just sits there silently staring at Edward on the TV screen. And this is when Kevin turns from being adorable bestie to Edward to starting to be like a mini Jim and being an asshole to Edward. And I'm like, Back in the studio, Edward is staring like a deer in the headlights. His heart is saying, I love Kim with every ounce of my being. But he knows that is something better kept inside.
Excellent Edward Scissorhands impression, Corinne.
Thank you. I felt like I was having a moment. He finally leans forward to answer the question. And we'll find out what happens after the break. We're back. When we left off, Edward was about to answer about having a girlfriend. He leans forward and accidentally snips the mic cord, giving himself an electric shock. Question successfully dodged. Kevin and Jim laugh at Edward, who is knocked out on the stage, but Kim is not impressed. Don't laugh, he's hurt. Jim chuckles. What? It's funny. I'm pissed I didn't record this because then I could have rewatched this over and over. Oh, Jim, you're such a mensch.
No, he's not. Later, Joyce is gone to space.
I'm just going to completely... No, he's not. And
he's not.
Disagreement, end of story, bam, we're done here.
Later, Joyce has found a space in a small strip mall for Edward to cut hair. She shows him around, pointing to different areas and spelling out what could be done with them, including a wall that will be great for selling makeup. Edward softly says, Peg could sell her makeup. And Joyce quickly brushes this off because she really needs to show Edward the back room. It's got the best thing back there. It's called sexual harassment.
Ooh.
She shoves him into the treatment chair and asks if he'd like to see her try on some of the cutting smocks she brought. He says yes, and she presses play on her cassette player and some sultry music comes on. She shows him an absolutely useless gauzy drape for keeping all that itchy hair off of you, and then models another drape that's a deep purple and way more useful. She stretches it tight across her chest, and he points, "I like that one." And she must have thought that he was pointing at her tatas or that that was an invitation, because she proceeds to climb up on his lap. He looks nervously unsure of what's happening while Joyce uses his scissors to open up her top. She has some black lacy lingerie underneath. She slowly leans forward to get a kiss. When the chair tips over and falls back, they both tumble to the floor, and Edward uses this opportunity to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
He walks quickly over to the diner where he meets Peg and the family for food. Edward explains, "Sorry I was late. Joyce was showing me the potential salon location." He turns to Peg, "And you could have a makeup counter there." This pleases Peg until Edward continues, "And then she showed me around the salon and took me to the back room where she took all her clothes off." Everyone's jaw drops except for Bill, who's only half paying attention and remarks, "Well, that's just great, Ed. Owning your own business is the best thing you could do in the world. I mean, I haven't experienced it, but from what I heard it is. You shouldn't have any trouble getting a loan to start up your business with all the references you have." Ha ha! Joke's on you!
You know, in Mystic Pizza, we talked about how 80s movies kind of glamorized some sexual dynamics that weren't, like, the most healthy. Like the 30-year-old architect hitting on the 18-year-old, hopefully, girl.
Yeah.
And how it romanticized a lot of things that just weren't good to romanticize. And in Edward Scissorhands and also in Mystic Pizza, both of these were kind of played off as jokey kind of things. Joyce climbing onto Edward Scissorhands and, like, completely being sexually inappropriate with him. And also JoJo, like, trying to forcefully strip off her boyfriend's pants and pull out his winky, as you said, when he was like being like, "No, I don't want to." And it was like, it didn't occur to me until years later that, oh, guys don't want sex all the time. There are times when there was this underlying cultural assumption that guys just want it. So, like, no matter when you give it to them, they're ready. And it's like, no, yeah. No, guys can say no and not actually want sex too.
Yes. And you should also respect that.
What?
To hell you say? That's just crazy talk.
I know. But yeah. The next section I entitled Lone Schmoan and Jim is a Dick. I know that was kind of hard to figure out whether or not Kim's boyfriend Jim was a dick or not, but I'm just putting it out there.
Jim the jock?
Yeah.
The one that was laughing at him when he got electrocuted?
Yeah.
Jim's a bad person?
Uh-huh. Shut up. I know.
Shocking. Haha, get it? Because he was electrocuted.
Oh! And the jokes, they just keep on coming.
Pew, pew, pew.
Bill proves that he knows nothing about whether somebody can qualify for a bank loan or not, because when Peg and Edward go to the bank for a loan, Edward is denied because, as the bank manager says, it's like you don't exist. He has no credit, no social security card, no identification of any kind, not even a Starbucks cup with his name on it.
What?
I know! No collateral of any kind, just a pile of references of happy customers that paid him absolutely no money, because if they'd actually paid for his services, he wouldn't need a loan.
Fair.
The manager tells him, get a social security card and a car and come back to us when we might be able to do something for you. Getting a car should be easy. Heck, you'll get a handicap placard and be able to park anywhere. Edward just stares at him and Peg is very disappointed.
It's so funny because the visuals in this section, like, they're in this huge empty room,
yeah,
with a huge bank vault behind them.
Yeah.
And it's open and the guards are walking in and out of the vault as he's, like, explaining the loan process. And then once the loan officer denies him, you slowly see the bank vault door creep and closed. And then when the final, no, you can't, slam shut, the little pinwheel lock goes into place and then everybody disperses. It's like, this bank is closed up to you, sir. You get no money. No money for you.
We thought we would open the vault for you, and we did, but you are denied.
Yes.
Slam.
Da, 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 da. You don't know that song? Slam. Da, 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 da. Let the boys be boys. It's like an old school song that just exploded in my head when you said slam.
Oh, let the boys be boys. That song has a lot of promise for being very progressive. It's
super feminist forward. I don't know. Have you heard that feminist jam? Slam. Da, 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 let the boys be boys. Because the boys will definitely honor and uphold all the women in their life and hold them up like equals. That's the next.
Feminist forward. I love that term. Definitely sounds like a feminist forward song. I'm very excited to hear this. Right, I can't wait.
Like the Indigo Girls.
Okay, but back to the movie. So, next thing we know, Jim, whose parents are rich, they have a four-head VCR after all. Just think about the clarity you get from all those heads, huh? Tamara's very impressed.
I don't think more heads makes it better.
No, it does. The cheapest VCRs are like a two-head VCR and then four-head VCR. Bam.
Uh-huh. All technology that's perfectly relevant to discuss today.
Yes. So Jim is talking with Kim about breaking into the room where his dad keeps all his valuables so that Jim can steal them, sell them, and buy a van just like his friend has so he can have his own van with the mattress in the back. Arrr. Isn't that exciting?
No. Mm-mm. I have thoughts about that van that I'm holding on to until we get to the portion where I'm like, what the fuck?
Okay. Interesting. So now we should... Your dad had a van, too.
Yes, I know. It was called the Glue Glue Van, and it was made of like 18 different colors. It was a patchwork of color van, and it was a piece of shit, and I almost fell out of the passenger side rolling down the freeway. Well, not rolling. We were going like 60-something miles, and it almost... The door didn't shut properly, and I almost flew out of it. I think I've told this story before on this podcast. My dad quickly grabbed onto me, put my shirt in his fist, and pulled over slowly to the side of the road, and then proceeded to get mad at me because the door opened up.
Of course. Tamara, you shouldn't be playing with the door.
Yeah. Oh, God. I was just like looking at him like, is this fucking van mine? No. I'm eight.
Oh my gosh, the things that we're held responsible for as children.
Yeah.
And also, in that van, there were two, there was the driver's seat, there was the front passenger seat, and then the rest was just open.
Yeah.
Which is where you were when you were playing with the door opening it on the freeway, Tam.
No, I was in the passenger seat. Also, my sister and I used to, like, do acrobatics up and down the seats of the van, so we would, like, you know, flop our stomachs over the headrest and then slide down into the empty back. And like we did that over and over again until my sister, God love her, there was a huge metal spike sticking up and she slid over and ripped her thigh open.
Oh no!
Oh, the 80s.
Ooh.
Where cars were amusement parks and they really shouldn't have been. You've got thrills, you've got spills. Do you want to risk your life and a tetanus shot crawling over the passenger side seat? Maybe not. Do you want to chance traffic and possibly tumble out into the freeway? No. There's not much more exciting than driving down the street or being parked in my dad's van. All the chills and spills that you can get at Six Mountains all rolled up into a glue glue.
I know. I was vehicle. Like, it's like Adventure Park, except van style.
Yeah. And more dangerous, apparently.
Now, I think that we should all take a moment to feel really sorry for Jim, because if his dad wasn't so stingy, he wouldn't be driven to do this, stealing from his parents. Can you believe that his dad wants him to buy his own car? Child abuse, am I right?
Did you just not hear me talk about the seat ripping thigh and the fucking... almost pummeling out into the freeway from a door opening up? I'm not feeling sorry for this guy. Not at all.
It's the only way that Jim can get money for the van, am I right?
I don't think he wants a van. I mean, those things are dangerous. I'm just saying.
He does want a van. He wants a mattress in the back so he can, like, have his rolling bedroom so he can fuck Kim whenever he wants.
Great. Yeah. Poor deprived Jim. Let's start a GoFundMe account for Jim.
Yes. Jim definitely needs a GoFundMe account. There's just one problem. Jim's dad is a security nut and he has everything locked away. But if Kim convinces Edward to help him, this won't be a problem either. Kim doesn't like the idea, but after some pressuring, goes along with it and ultimately convinces Edward to help Jim by telling him that someone stole Jim's stuff and they're just there to get it back. However, things go terribly wrong. As soon as Edward unlocks the door to the room that all the valuables are in, and he walks into the room, the door slams shut, and he becomes trapped in the room with the complete inability to get out because even if he could unlock the door, he can't turn the doorknob. Jim and his burglary crew run off, and Kim doesn't want to leave Edward behind, but Jim throws Kim over his shoulder, and they skedaddle into the van with flames on the side. Kim keeps on asking the driver to turn back, and in this movie, I remember the Winona Ryder character being just like this really like kind of innocent, somewhat cool kind of person. And I gotta say that the role of Kim is a really bad role. It's just, there's no, like, it's just super one-dimensional and not interesting in any way, shape, or form. And a little bit whiny. So Kim keeps on asking the driver to turn back, but Jim insists that they keep on driving away. If my dad catches me, he'll prosecute me, and I can't have that. And if Edward says anything about me being involved, I will kill him. And I felt like he was being serious when he said that.
I just have a couple of thoughts. First of all, if you're going to rob a house, maybe you want to get a more inconspicuous vehicle besides a van with flames on the side.
What?
Especially when you're the only one in the neighborhood that has said van. And also, Jim, if your dad's valuables go missing inexplicably and he already suspects you, and then a couple of weeks later you show up with your own van with flames on the side, don't you think he'd be a wee bit suspicious?
Okay, I'm just going to have to stop you there because his van would not have flames on the side. His van would have skulls with, like, you know, smoke coming out from behind them.
Oh, yeah. Completely different. Okay, I can see the logic there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm with you.
Yeah.
Police have surrounded Jim's house. They announce that they're disabling the alarm, and they tell whoever is in there to come out with their hands up. Edward obliges, but the police think he's holding weapons because of his hands. He just keeps on walking forward amidst the police persistent threats to drop your weapons or we'll shoot. And fortunately, he's white, so he gets real close to the officers, which is enough time for the neighbor ladies to intervene, explaining that they know him and those are his hands, not weapons.
This whole scene was like, I was just like, let's not have Edward mowed down in the middle of this movie.
The cops arrest Edward. The whole time he's booked in his holding cell, Edward doesn't say a word. Peg and Bill pick him up from the station, and Peg says, "Oh, this isn't what I meant by we'll find the money for the salon somewhere." Oh. She remarks to Bill, "I should have never been so envious of all of Jim's parents' stuff." Bill says to Edward, "What were you thinking? What were you going to do with all that stuff once you had it?" And Peg says, "Oh, Edward, stealing isn't the way to get things." Bill adds, "Except trouble, and you're in a lot of that." Edward looks down. Peg beseeches him, "Oh, Edward, why did you do this?" She turns to Bill, "Damn those TV programs." And he replies, "Damn them all to hell." And then suddenly Peg gets to the heart of the matter and asks, "Did someone put you up to this?" And his head goes down even lower. At Edward's court hearing, we see his arresting officer, the only black person in the entire Milky White movie, who asks the psychiatrist, "Is it going to be okay, Doc?" And Doc McBaldy, not his real name, explains that due to his extreme...
For the good name for him.
It's very fitting. I'm not going to lie, it's very fitting. Due to his extreme isolation, he's going to have a hard time differentiating right from wrong. And his work indicates that he's highly imaginative and that his awareness of reality is radically underdeveloped. Edward's watching, taking in everything that Doc McBaldy is saying, and the police officer asks, "Sure, but is it going to be all right, Doc, out there?" Doc McBaldy says glibly, in spite of everything he's previously said. Oh, yeah, he'll be fine. The police officer goes over to Edward and says, you take care of yourself. I don't want to stay up all night worrying about you. And it's kind of sweet that he seems to have a soft spot for Edward, but Edward doesn't seem to care and walks off after we assume he's been released. So I just want to unpack this little part for a bit because interesting casting choice making the one officer a black man who is concerned about Edward's safety and well-being as he is different from the other people of the community. Corinne, thoughts?
Oh, like those thoughts is what I have to say. I was so distracted by the completely, what is going on here? We have no idea what happens with his sentencing or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Huge kind of plot black hole that I...
Not important. Apparently not important or integral to the storyline.
We're just letting him go. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
You want it. You hold on there. Because if you think that is bad, you wait till the end where I'm full of all kinds of what the fuck? Seriously? What is up with the law enforcement in this town? If you feel that way at this point, you're going to feel very strongly at the end with me as well when we get to it. Because I have questions upon questions.
And I have a whole lot of big feelings.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Five of the ladies, including Molester Joyce, who were all big supporters of Edward, gather on the corner of the sidewalk, gossiping about how you never know someone, and it could have been any of our houses. In just a moment, Edward has turned from charming grooming savant to cat burglar. Esmeralda approaches, hissing at the women. See, now you believe me. He's from Satan. Beware. And when Peg pulls up to the house with Edward in the car, does she go up the driveway so that they'll be close to the door? No, she instead pulls up in front of the house so that they can be completely molested by reporters.
Why didn't she go into her secret car nook that's by the house?
Yes, we need her secret car nook. She apparently forgot the passcode. I don't know. She was disoriented.
Mm, got it.
There's a news van waiting outside to get the scoop, but Peg savvily escorts Edward out of the car and into the house, shouting, "No comment!" repeatedly over her shoulder. Later, when Peg is talking to one of Edward's clients who canceled their cut, the woman on the other end of the phone asks, "Are you going to be too embarrassed to have your Christmas party this year because of Edward's arrest?" And Peg, who holds big love for Edward, insists, "No, we're holding the party and we're not ashamed of anything." Later, Kim comes home. Oh, Kim, I got problems with you, Kim. Kim, like, this whole thing could easily be resolved with Kim.
But?
Kim and her peachy, long wig hair. She mm-hmm. comes home and she's surprised to find Edward at the house. She apologizes to him. I'm sorry we left you. I tried to make them go back for you, but they wouldn't. You must have been surprised when you found out it was Jim's house. Edward looks at her and softly says, I knew it was his house. I did it because you asked me to. The reality of the depth of her manipulation washes over her, and she feels like an even bigger shit of a person than she previously did, as well she should. However, their conversation is interrupted by Jim calling to her from the backyard. Kim! Kimba! Kimmy! She rushes out to him, and Edward is pissed. He's feeling feelings and immediately shreds some curtains. And Kim, what does she do to make things right in this situation?
Oh, she apologizes. Yeah, sorry. Sorry you got caught. Sorry conned you into breaking into his house. Wow. Must have felt stupid when you found out it was his house, huh? She actually, like, it's so weird because she has, like, agency over her actions, but it's always in the wrong parts and it's always too little too late. Like, she's like, go back. We can't leave him. I was like, you shouldn't be there in the first place, Kim.
Well, yeah, and she could have gone to the police station and made some kind of a statement. After Edward was home, she could have talked to her parents and said, hey, here's what happened.
I'm waffling between she was trying to save her own ass or she's afraid of Jim because he threatened Edward with death. And I don't know if he would be that far off from doing something to her if she, you know, came forward with the truth.
I honestly have no doubt that she is in an abusive relationship with Jim.
Mm, Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still doesn't excuse it.
Nah.
And I agree with you. When Kim approaches Jim on the lawn, Edward has already walked back into the deeper recesses of the house, so he doesn't see that Jim's trying to reach Kim for a hug, but she rebuffs him and gets him pissed. He accuses, "What's your problem? I did what I could for the guy. My old man thinks Edward's head is full of cotton candy, and that's why he let him go. What else do you want from me?" Kim rebuts, "You could have told the truth, but Jim isn't having it." "So could you, but you haven't. You were there, too." Kim defends, "Yeah, but I didn't want to be there." "Choo-choo. Okay, Kim, this is where your logic train derails. Why don't you say something?" Ugh. This was Corinne's banner writing. Kim turns on her heel and leaves, with Jim yelling after her, "I don't get why you give a shit anyways." Meanwhile, Edward is spiraling in the house, running his scissor hands down hallways, shredding the wallpaper in the bathroom and the towels. Over dinner, Bill gives a fatherly lecture to Edward about rebuilding trust and poses a lame hypothetical question to him, asking what he would do if he found a briefcase full of money. Edward says he would give it to friends, and Peg gently lets him know that while that seems like the right answer, it isn't. And in a reversal, Kim defends him, saying that the answer makes the most sense. And Kevin, the little brother who's an asshole now, says snobbily, "Obviously, you turn it over to the police," completely ignoring the fact that he had proudly stated previously, "I'd keep the money for myself," a few moments ago. Kevin, you little two-faced bastard.
He'd probably give it to Jim for his approval so that Jim could get his rolling bed on wheels with skulls on the side of it.
Yeah, that would be the best investment. No, it would be.
Ugh. Edward's world has gone from being very open and people-filled to now basically Peg, whose hair keeps getting shorter and shorter because she keeps on having Edward give her haircuts. Bless her heart! Oh!
Yeah, because Kim's too busy, and then he tries to engage with Kevin, like, "Do you want to play rock, paper, scissors?" And Kevin's like, "No, that's boring." So now, like, everybody is shunning him. Inexplicably, it's not his fault.
Although, I think that Kim could really use a haircut from Edward, because, boy, that hair. However, it's Christmas time, and Peg's family is getting ready for the Christmas party. Bill is up on the roof, adding fake snow to it, singing, "I saw three ships come sailing in." Peg and Kim are decorating their artificial white Christmas tree, and Edward is in the backyard carving an angel out of a giant piece of ice. Peg thinks the Christmas party will fix everything, and Kim is dubious. However, Kim isn't worrying about this for long, because when she goes to get more bells for the tree, falling snow outside catches her eye. She wanders in the backyard, flakes of snow fall dreamily from the sky, and they're all created by Edward, who is sculpting a 10-foot-tall angel. Kim is captivated by the moment, reaching out her arms and slowly spinning in wonder. And the scene is fucking beautiful, and it's like what you think of when you think of Edward Scissorhands, basically.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. She slowly starts approaching Edward, who is making his way down the ladder. Down the ladder. It's like I used your talk to text. Jesus Christ.
There's nothing wrong with my talk to text.
Nothing wrong at all, except it would say down the ladder, like I did, apparently, even though I typed it. When Jim enters the backyard yelling, "Hey!" Edward jerks his arm down, accidentally slashing Kim's palm open, and Jim goes on the attack. He points at Edward. "Stay the fuck away from her. If you touch her again, I'll kill you." Kim insists, "It was an accident. It's okay." And Peg, hearing the commotion, whisks Kim away to tend to her cut. Jim goes into full bully mode. "Who do you think you are hanging around here? Why don't you go back where you belong?" He pushes Edward. "Get the hell out of here. Go, you freak." Edward starts running away, and Bill finally tunes into what's going on down in his yard as he sees Edward's retreating form going down the street. He yells after him, "Hey, Edward, where you going?" But it's too late. Edward is gone. Kim comes out in the backyard asking, "Where's Edward?" And Jim indignantly replies, "He tried to hurt you." Kim isn't backing down. "No, he didn't, and you know it. I don't love you anymore, and I want you to go." Jim is pissed. "I'm losing you to that? But he isn't even human." Kim yells, "Get out of here. Go." Jim retreats, but he's not happy about it. Aww. let us take a moment and hold Jim in our hearts as he goes through this really difficult time.
Corinne, yes? Will you stop sympathizing with untrucked Jim and his stupid-ass machismo feelings, please? I don't understand the soft spots you have for him.
He's just, you know, he's so vulnerable and he's had such a hard time dealing with, you know, these weirdos and not getting his van. I mean, what about that? His crime didn't even go right. Now he doesn't have a van with smoking skulls on the side and a bed in there so he can boink Kim whenever he wants.
Have you fallen down and hit your head? Is that what's happening?
I'm just trying to share the plight of the poor rich white guy.
Did somebody switch your brain with an appliance, much like Edward Scissorhands, Corinne Toaster Brain? What's going on with you?
They don't call me Coco Litches for nothing.
My brain is now a drip coffee machine that can also make cocoa.
I'll cocoa all the time. Liciousness.
And marshmallows dispense for my tatas. You're welcome. Kim asks her dad where Edward is, and he says, I don't know, he just went waltzing down the street. Peg assures her, don't worry, Kim, Dad will find him. And Kim and Peg go back into the house while Dad walks the neighborhood to look for Edward. However, Edward is on a tear. He cuts off his clothes. Fear not, his leather bondage gear is still underneath, so he's not naked. He amputates the leg off of one of his topiary people, stabs a car tire, and, in the sweetest piece of revenge ever, he sculpts a demon topiary in Esmeralda's front yard, complete with glowing red eyes created by strategically placed Christmas lights.
So it stares into her house. I loved that.
And it's so funny, too, because as he becomes the freak and everybody turns on him, it's so funny how Esmeralda just places herself amidst the bored housewives community as they're like, you know, talking shit about him.
Yeah.
So she's no longer the freak of the neighborhood. There's another freak and she can just gently place herself in with all the other lovely ladies of the ticky-tacky community.
Uh-huh. They're very loyal.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And she means that sarcastically.
Yes. Just like all of my Jim, my poor plight of Jim stuff.
When they're alone in the living room waiting on the Christmas party guests that will never come, Kim and Peg have a moment. Peg confesses to her daughter, I didn't think it through bringing him down here. I didn't realize how everyone and everything would be affected. And now I think he may be better off back on the hill because at least he'd be safe there because there's a gate. There's a gate to keep him in. There's a gate to keep him closed. There's a gate to keep him secure. There's definitely a gate there.
But is there a gate? Is it secure? Is there a gate that opens and closes?
You're going to have to wait to find that out, Missy. I've talked about the many other gates. You know, that one you need to wait on. Currently, Edward is not safe. By this point, the police are looking out for him. And by police, we mean the lone black man that's in the movie that actually cares for him. The neighborhood ladies are in a tizzy, and when Bill returns home after walking up and down the block, which, let's be honest, the neighborhood doesn't look that big.
Yeah.
So how hard was he actually going?
Seriously.
Bill and Peg decide to head out in the car and look for him, asking Kim to stay back in case anybody comes by. Edward sits dejected on the edge of the neighbor's driveway, and a shaggy dog approaches him. Edward looks at the dog, smiles, and does a snip with his fingers, clearing the hair from the front of the pupper's eyes.
Aww.
The dog gives him a thankful lick and scampers off. Edward watches him go up the street when a police cruiser rounds the corner and he gets the fuck out of there and goes back to Peg's house where Kim is alone waiting.
Ooh. Is she wearing clothes or is she in like a fur rug?
Yep. She has nothing on except her bad wig.
Strategically placed hair in different places, yes. Edward asks, once he gets inside, where is everyone? And Kim explains, they're looking for you. She looks soulfully up into his eyes and asks, will you hold me? He starts to, but then says no and walks over to the window. But Kim follows him over to the window and gently places his arms around her, and she hugs him. They stand there holding each other, and Edward flashes back to the moment where his inventor dad presents him with a beautiful set of hands. Edward gently explores them with his scissor hands, looking at them in wonder. Inventor Dad is so pleased, but then suddenly he gets a look of pain on his face. He falls, thrusting the hands into Edward's scissors and destroying them. Inventor Dad crumples onto the floor, dying. Edward looks at his dad and gently strokes the side of his face, drawing some blood. Edward then flashes forward, to the present, looking at his scissor blades as his arms are wrapped around Kim.
So sad and heartbreaking. Ooh. It's a beautiful moment that's about to be ruined by a very drunk Jim, the one that Corinne has such a soft spot in her heart for.
I just think, you know, he needs a little guidance. He's just misunderstood.
He needs a lot more than guidance.
And you know boys will be boys.
Oh, slam, da-da-da. No, they won't. Jim has his very drunk friend drive him over to Kim's house to defend her against Edward. Kim and Edward from inside hear the van careening down the street. Edward looks out the window and sees a topiary being plowed down by the drunk driver and Kevin walking very near it. He springs into action, rushing outside and whisking Kevin out of harm's way in the nick of time, but accidentally cutting up Kevin's face with his scissors when they roll out of the way. The neighborhood comes out and chaos ensues. Edward accidentally slashes a neighbor and Peg and Bill arrive in the nick of time. They grab Kevin and Edward's supposed to come with them, but Jim starts attacking him. Edward defends himself, cutting Jim's arm, and that obviously makes Edward a monster, right? Kim tells Edward to run, and he does, with the police officer slowly following after him. Edward makes it down the street and retreats to his old house on the hill. Hold on.
Oh, I know. It's perfect timing.
The police! Well, there's another one. But in Edward's scissor hand, there's only one lone cop car. Here, there's two. At the entry to the house on the hill, the police officer fires his gun several times, but not at Edward, and announces to the neighborhood that everything's okay and it's all over. And then he drives away.
Yeah.
But shockingly, it's not all over. That's not enough for the villagers who start going up the path. Might as well have torches and pitchforks. However, Kim's managed to get ahead of the mob and finds Edward back in his home. She effuses, "I'm so glad you're here. I was worried about you." He asks if Kevin's okay, and she explains that yes, he was mainly just scared, and then confesses, "I was so afraid I thought you were dead." Suddenly, a person comes out of the shadows saying, "I didn't," and it's fucking Jim with a fucking gun.
Oh.
He shoots towards Edward, missing, but causing some of the ceiling to crumble and fall on top of him. Jim starts kicking him while he's down, and then starts beating him up with the fireplace poker. Kim knocks Jim over, but Jim doesn't quit. Ultimately, Edward gets up and lunges at Jim with his scissor hands, stabbing him through the chest and causing him to fall out of the window dramatically. This is good news for the world, but not for Edward or Kim and their burgeoning love.
Aww.
He stares softly at her and says, "Goodbye." They kiss and she folds into his arms and whispers, "I love you." And Edward closes his eyes because those are the words he always wanted to hear. But she's got to go save her boo now, so she runs back out of the house to head off the villagers, grabbing an old model of his scissor hands as she heads out the door. Kim stands at the entry to the house and announces to everyone, "He's dead! The roof caved in on him, and they killed each other!" She's wearing a white dress with a giant splotch of blood on it. She holds up the scissor hands as proof and says, "See?" And everyone believes her and retreats. Years later, we know that Edward still exists because a very old version of Winona Ryder that we mentioned in the beginning is telling her granddaughter that that's why it snows. It never used to snow in their ticky-tacky community, but now it does. And up on that hilltop, we get to see Edward still shaving up blocks of ice and sculpting works of art as the snow arcs out over onto the valley floor. Before we say the end, I just want to point out the glaring discrepancy that there's apparently two bodies up in that hill that no one is acknowledging or doing anything about. There's dead Jim on the floor that they can see, and the theoretic dead Edward Scissorhands that's inside the house, and nobody thinks to call the cops because, I don't know, maybe that's not their job. Maybe they're just supposed to herd bad people to where they belong and then leave, and that's all they have to say about that.
My head hurts. hurts with this random weird ending.
Yeah.
And also, like, if I were fucking Kim, I would be like, oh, I'm gonna be sneaking up there and like, and, you know, bringing him stuff and like hanging out with him on the sly. Like,
yeah.
But she doesn't do that, you know?
No. And I think. Old Winona Ryder tells us that she doesn't go back up there because now she's an old lady and she wants Edward to remember her as young and beautiful when she first met him. So it is abundantly clear that she never goes back up there after this evening.
Yeah. Oh, great. You got rid of Jim. Now, bye. Like,
yeah. Now I'm single, so I'm never going to see you again. Okay. Sounds good. All right.
They had a kiss and done. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe she didn't want to deal with the whole whisk in his pants, you know?
Okay, I already explained to you that it's a funnel.
Okay, well, that's in your world. In my mind, it's a whisk, and I don't know how fun that would be in the bedroom.
Whisks are always fun. Are you kidding? Plus, I mean, no better way to get some scrambled eggs going. Just saying.
Yes, but then he also might scramble her eggs if they try to do the deed.
Baby scissor hands. Aww.
No. Imagine what it would be like to give birth to a baby scissor hand baby. Never mind. We've gone too far off the tracks. Corinne, the end. There. Now, how many dry kisses do you give Edward scissor hands?
I don't know. I'm so confused.
We had this discussion at the top of the movie, at the top of the show, and I said, I think I'm going to give it a user rating of you for undecided because I didn't know how to feel about this movie. Used to love it, not so much now, but I am very conflicted, as is Corinne apparently.
Yeah, I'm very conflicted. I honestly would give Love Actually a you, and I would give this a you. Two totally different reasons, and Love Actually is a way better movie than this movie. But Love Actually, I was just like all over the place with how I felt about the different plot lines and stuff like that. And this, I was like, I mean, like, it's kind of magical and also very bad at the same time.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And Winona Ryder was a big name at that point in time. So They scored her and they gave her this nothing burger of a role. Like, her character was characterless, and yeah,
well, she played the portrayal that was very common of the time of like the damsel in distress. You just need a pretty girl that's gonna like have all the police again hopefully coming to get Edward off of that hill. If it wasn't a female centric movie like 9 to 5 or Working Girl, like they just have to have the quintessential love interest girl that whose personality, plotline, and agency is only vital to the plotline that the director, person, whatever, writer wants it to be. So it was always like a bunch of nothing burgers. Like there were so many nothing burgers roles back in like the late 80s, early 90s that, yeah, it's not surprising that that's the role that she played.
Ugh. It's just like you go from Heathers to this.
Oof. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I give it a U. What do you give this?
Although initially I wanted to give it a U along with you, Corinne, I'm just going to give this a solid 3 for a few reasons. Uh-huh. I agree with you wholeheartedly that it is magical. It is got glaring holes in the plot that I'm just like, now even more. So like, you're going to go up there and get that dead body there, please? No? Okay. I guess that's fine. I'm just, don't ever go up there again, any Avon ladies. There's going to be a strong, pungent smell coming from that driveway. But the thing about it is like, this was Tim Burton's kind of like coming into his own. I am a fan of Tim Burton, and he spurred a whole genre of artists that like exploded out of these movies like fireworks. And so he very much kind of changed the cinematic world. And I think that is something. And so I would just say, like, see this. This is the bottom step of many creative things that came after it. And even though it's not a pillar of anything that, you know, we lean heavily on now, it was still the beginning of something special. So is it a magical movie? Yes. Is it a particularly good movie? No.
Okay.
But
I was thinking, oh, this has got to be like his first movie.
Mm-mm.
But Beetlejuice, which is way more interesting, way more evolved, right, was done before this.
It was. And that was definitely, admittedly, a better movie. And I'm not saying, like, this wasn't the beginning of him. Beetlejuice had a very strong plot line that was, it's the afterlife. It's the creepiness. There's ghosts. There's ghouls. There's goblins. Like, and he leaned into that. But this one was a love story that he put that kind of, like, emo twist on that it didn't need. And that is where the difference lies. Like, there was ghosts and there was ghouls, and that was his strong suit. And so he carried this over into this Edward Scissorhands movie. And that is where the whole start of the Tim Burton is, like, really kind of took off, because he went into those dark, dreary worlds and he made them into something that they normally wouldn't be in anybody else's hands.
And I mean, I agree. I like the creativity of it for sure. I just felt like it was all show and no grow.
Well, yeah. And that's why that's the reason why I think people should watch it for the show, not the grow. Like, see it for what it is, but don't expect it to be a great movie. So that's why I give it a middle of the road, 3 dry kisses. Like, definitely would watch it again just for what it is, but don't expect it to be anything great. Bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah. No, which is why, okay, I will give it an actual rating. I'll give it 2.5 dry kisses. I would give it 3 dry kisses if it was an earlier movie of his, but he had already done Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Batman. He'd already done well-formed movies that were surreal and strange and interesting.
And that's why you weren't listening to my... because you were diving into his previous movies. I see you, Corinne. I know how you operate.
No, I was listening to everything you were saying.
Uh-huh. While you were researching his other movies. I get it. I'm just saying, like, this to me was a quintessential Tim Burton movie. Yes, all the other ones were dark and brooding and had the starts of his creativity, but this one was the turn in the road to me. Not saying it's any better or worse than the other ones. I'm just like, this is where he twisted it and was like, something cutesy and wholesome could be turned dark. Like, Nightmare Before Christmas came after this, and The Corpse Bride came after this, and Frankenweenie came after this. And it's, so he went into a different dark direction, and I think this was the rotating point.
I would say Beetlejuice was the rotating point, and it was a way better movie.
Agree to disagree. Agree to disagree.
So, Miss Tamara, what movie do we have coming up next week?
Next week, we are doing Just Like Heaven, a movie inexplicably that I owned it 4 different times for various reasons on DVD, VHS, and Blu-ray.
Fantastic. I love Reese Witherspoon, Mark Ruffalo. And then we have the epic, what's his name, from Napoleon Dynamite, who played Napoleon Dynamite.
John Heder.
John Heder, who asks for a cola in it.
I know. I don't know why he didn't do more after, like, I really enjoyed him in Just Like Heaven, and I thought this was going to be, like, his breaking off point away from Napoleon Dynamite, and he didn't do much after this.
I think he was busy being a Mormon and, like, holding on to his Mormon values.
Oh, that'll do it.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time to be a Mormon and hold on to your Mormon values, yeah.
I think that he was willing to work in, like, a very specific type of movie.
Surprised that he got Just Like Heaven then, because he was a medium.
Oh! Ooh. Yeah, maybe he had a come to Jesus moment after that. But yes, so super looking forward to this movie. And if you have anything you'd like to say to us about Edward Scissorhands, and if there's, like, a depth to it that I wasn't picking up on, or you completely agree with Tamara and you're like, yeah, that was his visual turning point for everything, please, you can reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all at One Dry Kiss.
And that's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you can find the time to rate and review us, you'll get a cool sticker out of it, as Corinne said at the top of the show. So please put in those 5-star ratings if you can. But in the meantime, we appreciate you stopping by. And we bid you adieu with one dry kiss. Mwah! We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
on my ass.
It's beautiful.